Let's welcome our speaker today, Dr. Gabor Maté from Vancouver, BC.
So, can you hear me at the back? Yeah? Good. If I fade out, just please let us know. Thank you very much for having me speak at your conference. It's a pleasure and an honor. I've been much impressed with the work of AA and related 12-step organizations. I also have some significant disagreements, which you will hear in great detail very shortly.
What's your name?
My first name is Gabor, G-A-B-O-R. Surname is Maté, M-A-T-E. You realize, of course, that I'm a medical doctor, and I'm diagnosing you guys as I'm looking at you. and I'll tell you the diagnosis in a few minutes. So I've been a family physician, and I'm also an author of a number of books. And for the last 12 years, I've worked in Vancouver's downtown east side, which is known as North America's most heavily concentrated area of drugs. In a few square block radius, we have thousands of people using injection drugs. Many of them, of course, are also hooked on alcohol. And this is the famous DTES, Vancouver's Downtown East Side. Now, my patients there are at the extreme end of the addiction scale. And they don't live very long. They die usually in their 40s, early 50s at the very latest. They die of HIV, of hepatitis C and its complications, of cancers, of overdoses, of suicides, of violence, infections, and so on. And so the question of what causes these heavily punitive, self-destructive habits has exercised my mind, of course, all the time that I've worked there. And as I may have time to tell you, I've had my own issues with addictive behaviors as well, although not with substances specifically. I'm going to read you a little bit from the second chapter of my book on addiction. The title of the book is In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction. And the question I ask in this chapter, which is entitled The Lethal Hold of Drugs, is what is the truly fatal attraction of the drug experience? And I include in that, of course, alcohol. That's a question I've put to many clients at the clinic at which I work. You've got this miserable, swollen, ulcerated leg and foot, red hot and painful, I say to Hal, a friendly, jocular man in his 40s, one of my few male patients without a criminal record. You have to drag yourself to the emergency ward every day for IV antibiotics. You have HIV, and yet you won't give up injecting speed. What do you suppose is behind that for you? I don't know, Hal mutters, his toothless gums smothering his words. You ask anybody, including myself, why should you put something into your body that in the next few minutes makes you drool, look gooey, you know, distort your brainwave patterns to the point where you can't think reasonably, inhibits your speech patterns, and then want to do it again? And I'm sure you've asked yourself the same question many times. And gives you an abscessed leg, I add helpfully. Yes, an abscessed leg. Why, I really don't know. In March 2005, I had a very similar discussion with Alan, also in his 40s, also with HIV. Alan had been to Vancouver Hospital with sharp chest pains a few days earlier. He was told he'd probably suffered a flare-up of endocarditis, an infection of the heart valves. Declining to be admitted to the hospital, Alan presented himself instead for a second opinion at the emergency ward of St. Paul's Hospital, where he was assured that everything was fine. Now he was in my office for a third assessment. On examination, I can see that he isn't acutely ill, but is nevertheless in terrible shape. What should I do, Doc? He asks, raising his shoulders and spreading his arms out in helpless consternation. Okay, I say, reviewing his chart. Your father died of heart disease. Your brother died of heart disease. You're a heavy smoker. You have a history of endocarditis from IV drug use. I'm treating you for cardiac failure, and even now your legs are swollen because your heart isn't pumping efficiently. Your HIV is controlled by strong medications, and with hepatitis C, your liver is just hanging in there. But you still keep injecting, and you're asking me what you should do? What's wrong with this picture? I was hoping you'd say that, Alan replies. You need to tell me I'm a fucking retard. It's the only way I learn. Okay, I oblige. You're a fucking retard. Thanks, Doc. The trouble is, you're not a fucking retard. You're addicted. And how are we to understand that? Alan died 4 months later, cold and blue at midnight, on the floor of his room in a nearby hotel. He was injecting, rumor had it, from a bad lot of methadone heisted in a break-in at a local pharmacy and subsequently adulterated with crystal meth or who knows what. According to the coroner's office, that little enterprise in independent drug marketing caused the death of at least eight people. I'm not afraid of dying, a client told me. Sometimes I'm more afraid of living. And so that's the question. What is it that makes people so afraid of life? Now, in North America, when it comes to addictions, including alcoholism, there are a number of myths. By the way, this lecture was originally entitled A Modern Medical View of Addiction, and I asked them to change that. Because I'm not giving you the modern medical view of addiction. I think the modern view of medical addiction is hopelessly narrow. And that's why the title was changed to A New Medical View of Addiction, because I'm telling you what the latest science tells me, and also what my experience tells me. So in North America, the usual answer to the question of why people do these things to themselves is that they've made a bad choice. They've just made a bad decision. They're morally flawed, ethically weak, they lack the will. They're just caught in some bad decision from which all their troubles follow. Now, I'm telling you, that's a myth. Nobody chooses to be an alcoholic. Nobody chooses to be addicted. Nobody chooses to have HIV. Nobody wakes up one morning and says, hey, what I want to do when I grow up is to be an alcoholic. It's not a decision anybody makes. It's something that people gravitate into or fall into for a set of very powerful reasons in their lives, which I'll tell you about in a while, and which I trust will resonate with your own experience. The second myth is that it's something you're born with. And that's the myth I heard articulated today already a couple of times. People are born constitutionally unable to be honest. Nobody's born. Have you ever met a one-day-old infant who couldn't be honest? And how, have you ever met a one-day-old infant who denied their feelings? Who pretended something that wasn't true? Nobody's born like that. And nobody's born addicted either. Nobody's born an alcoholic. It's true that alcoholism runs in families, but that doesn't make it a genetic problem. I mean, I'm a medical doctor. If two of my kids decided, and they haven't, and they're not going to become medical doctors, would that make the practice of medicine a genetic disorder? Well, it could be, but not automatically. So something running in families says nothing about whether or not it's genetic. There's all kinds of other reasons why somebody in a family with a multi-generational history of alcoholism might themselves become an alcoholic. So the idea that it's genetic is a myth. Now, what the two, and by the way, the third myth is that substances are in themselves are addictive. No, they're not. Substances are not addictive. Most people can be given morphine for severe pain, they never become addicted to it. A few people will. Most people can touch alcohol repeatedly, and even in reasonably large quantities. They never become alcoholics. Most people can go shopping and not become shopaholics. People can gamble and not be... But some people will become shopaholics. People will become gamblers, but not most people who play cards. They won't become gamblers. In other words, there's nothing intrinsically addictive about anything. It's the personal relationship to it that defines the addiction. And it's the personal predisposition. So what is it that makes some people prone and other people not prone to be addicted to a particular behavior or a substance or a way of being? That's the question I'm posing, and that's the question that I hope to answer for you today, including as it relates to alcohol use. Now, what you'll notice, there's some significant and very important differences between the choice perspective and the genetic inborn perspective. The choice perspective blames the individual. The genetic perspective that you're born with it at least doesn't blame you, because you can hardly help what genes you're born with, could you? You don't have any choice in that matter. So at least you take the blame off the individual. And you recognize that you're dealing with the disease here. And that means you're at least entitled to treatment. So the genetic or the inborn hypothesis is more humane and enlightened than the choice one. Incidentally, the choice one is what underlies social policy. The reason this country has got 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's jail population, is because the legal system is based on this myth of choice. So that if people are doing bad things, they should be punished because they're choosing to do it. And many of the people who are in the jails of this country are there because of drug or alcohol use, by the way. But what the two views do have in common, you'll notice, is that if you think something is due to a choice that somebody makes, or if you think it's due to some genetically inborn trait, you don't have to look at their lives. You don't have to look at what happened to them. You don't have to look at society. We don't have to ask ourselves, why is it that First Nations, as we call them, Canada, or Native Indian Americans in this country, why are they much more likely to be alcoholics and drug users? Now, if it's genetic, the poor people just can't help it. But then we don't have to look at history. We don't have to look at what happened to minority peoples in this country. We don't have to look at why black kids end up so often in jails because of drug use or drug trade. We don't have to look at the history of this country and what happened to black people in this country and what continues to happen. And individually, you don't have to look at your life. You don't have to look at what happened to you as a child, what may have shaped your development, what happened in your family multigenerationally that may have contributed to people turning to addictions. So all those questions, which are very painful, emotionally painful, and socially awkward, get not to be asked if you think something is choice or if you think it's genetic. Because scientifically, neither perspective makes any sense whatsoever. And that's what I will tell you. Before I come to the reasons to what makes us susceptible, let's look at the brain. I mean, you wanted to hear a bit of a scientific talk. I'll give you a bit of science here. What happens in the brain of the addicted individual, including in the brain of the alcoholic individual? Well, we know that the brains of addicts are not the same as the brains of non-addicts. How do we know that? All kinds of studies look at brain chemistry, and brain connections and brain physiology. There's certain circuits in the brains of addicts that don't work so well. This is true of course this is true of anybody after they've been using a substance for a long time. You can look at brain scans of people who've been using heroin for a long time or alcohol for a long time, and you can see shrinkage instead of growth. So that the drugs, the substances, definitely affect the brain and creating a diseased state in the brain. But the question is, what is the brain like before the addiction happens? What creates susceptibility? Well, let's look at the substances that are being used here. There are several important brain systems involved in the addiction process. Now, where I work in the downtown east side is with people that inject heroin, amongst other things. Now, what is about heroin? Well, heroin, of course, is a product of opium. And opium is a plant that grows in Asia. And people have been using opium or its derivatives for 3,000 years in medicine. And why do we use them? As many of you probably know, we use them widely and we use them generously views them as necessary, and they're really important. For what? Pain relief. In other words, opiates are pain relievers. Opiates are pain relievers. But they don't just relieve physical pain. They also relieve emotional pain. Because it turns out that the same circuits in the brain that interpret the emotional significance of physical pain also interpret the emotional significance of psychological pain. So when somebody feels rejected, the same part of the brain will light up as would light up as if you stuck them with a knife. And that's why we talk about a painful comment or a stab in the heart or a hurtful experience. Because emotionally, the pain is felt just as physical pain is felt. And that's where the opiates work, in that part of the brain. They're very active there. So addictions, let me tell you, every single addiction you can name, whether it's to cocaine is a local anesthetic. Did you know that? It's used as a local anesthetic. It's a painkiller. Alcohol is a painkiller. In fact, what do you say about somebody who's drunk too much? There's an old expression. They're feeling no pain. You've seen the cowboy movies where the cowboy gets shot and, you know, before the days of anesthesia, they have to dig out the bullet. What do they give him? It's whiskey. So alcohol is a painkiller. All the drugs are painkillers. And the first question in addiction that you need to ask is not why the addiction, but why the pain. Now, to understand people's pain, you have to look at their lives. Now, then if you ask the question, and by the way, in the brains of alcoholics, the less opiate activity there is, the more they crave alcohol. So the less opiate activity there is, the more they crave alcohol. Now, why is it that the opiates work in the human brain? Like, why is it that morphine or heroin, derived from a plant that grows in Asia, has such a powerful impact in your brain here in California or anywhere else in the world? It's because our brains have receptors for opiates. That means they have chemical sites where the opiates can bind and do their job. But why do we have receptors for opiates? Why do we have receptors for a plant that grows in Asia? Well, the answer is that we don't. What we do have receptors for are our own internal opiates, our own internal endogenous opiate systems. And our own endogenous opiates are called endorphins. Endorphin means endogenous internal opiate, internal morphine-like substance. So we have an opiate system in our brains. And the job of the opiate system is they do many, many things. They control our bowels and so on. But on the emotional level, what do they do? Well, first of all, they relieve pain. So the opiates relieve pain. Number one. Number two, they give us a sense of pleasure and reward, so we feel better about ourselves and about the world. And number three, their most important function is also the least understood one. Actually, they are responsible for the experience that you're all helping to provide each other with, which is the experience of love. Endorphins make love possible. Without endorphins, there's no loving contact. Now, why is that important? It's important for survival. We're not talking about luxuries here. We're talking about survival. Because the human being is the least mature, the most dependent, and the most helpless for the longest period of time of any creature in the universe. The human infant is. And so that love and connection is absolutely essential for survival. Now, if you take infant mice, and this has been done in a laboratory, and you knock out their endorphin receptors genetically, so they don't have the endorphin activity, they will not call for their mother when they're separated. Now, what would that mean in the wild for them? If an infant mice separated from the mother didn't cry for her, they would die. In other words, the opiate activity to which alcohol contributes. Without that activity, there'd be no human life. So you begin to get the picture that these addictions arise in brain circuits without which life is not even possible. That's why they're so powerful. Now, what if a human being came to the conclusion that without a particular substance, they can have no experience of love and connection, pleasure and reward, or pain relief? But through that substance, they could get those qualities in their lives. Well, how would you take it away from them? By telling them to stop it? Putting a sign on the wall saying, just say no? Other circuits are involved in addiction as well. There's another chemical called dopamine. Dopamine is important for reward and motivation and incentive and attention. And without it, we're like zombies. If you've seen the movie Awakenings with Robin Williams, where he's a psychiatrist and his patients lack dopamine, they're like zombies. They're listless. They're unmotivated. They don't interact. They don't do anything. They don't even speak. True story, by the way. And he gives them a medication that elevates their dopamine levels. Now they have motivation. They interact. They can be sociable. They can interact. They can be excited about things until the medication loses its effect. And then they descend back into their quiescent, zombie-like state. Now, by the way, alcohol, one of the things it does is it inhibits the inhibition of dopamine-releasing cells. To make a long story short, it increases dopamine flow in the brain. Now you have more incentive, more capacity to be sociable. Now imagine if somebody came to the conclusion that without, and by the way, dopamine is needed whenever you're exploring a novel object, exploring a novel environment, seeking food, seeking a sexual partner. You need dopamine flowing in your brain. And if it isn't, you're listless and you don't do these things. In other words, that's another brain circuit without which life is simply impossible. And again, imagine if somebody comes to the conclusion that without my particular substance, I have no motivation or incentive. I can't interact with people. I don't feel confident. I have no interest in things. How are you going to get them to stop? Putting a sign on the wall, just say no. Just say no to motivation and incentive. That's the second brain circuit involved in addiction. The third one has to do with impulse regulation and emotional self-regulation. Now, emotional self-regulation means that if something happens externally, you don't get overwhelmed. You can maintain a steady, stable internal environment. The person who doesn't have emotional self-regulation gets easily upset when something externally happens. Now, I got news for you. Nobody's born with internal emotional self-regulation. Babies can't regulate themselves emotionally. That's why they need adults. They don't just need adults physically. They need adults to help them regulate their emotions. So when a baby cries, they need to be regulated. Otherwise, they just stress themselves. And babies that are never picked up actually die because of that, even though you feed them. But if you don't pick them up, they die because the regulation internally is just lacking. And so emotional self-regulation and impulse regulation means that when I want to do something, I have an impulse to do something, I don't necessarily act it out. Well, addicts completely lack that. If you do a brain scan on addicts, the part of the brain that's most commonly found to be deficient is the impulse regulating part of the brain. You can see this on brain scans. Now, in other words, as somebody once said about addiction, the problem is not lack of free will, but lack of a free won't. The capacity to say no meaningfully is just not there. But the brain circuit isn't working. It's not something conscious or deliberate. The brain circuit's just not working. And finally, stress regulation. Addictions are all about stress regulation. Now, stress is something that happens. Something happens externally, you're stressed. Physically, your body changes, you go into a flight or fight mode. That's fine, you have to be able to survive. So you need to stress it to survive. But then you have to calm down. Addicts lack stress regulation, so they use substances to regulate their stresses. And if your own experience is any kind of a guide, you know perfectly well what I'm talking about. let's say you've not been using for a while, and then your partner leaves you, your boyfriend or girlfriend or somebody close to you seems to turn their back on you. The first thing you do, well, the first thing that happens, you get totally upset emotionally and physically stressed, and the second thing that happens, you reach for whatever will soothe your stress. So addictions are desperate attempts to regulate stress in people in whom the internal stress regulation just doesn't function well. And the question we're asking is, what happens to people so that these brain circuits don't function so well in the first place? Because they're the ones who are sitting ducks for addiction. They're the ones who, when they do the substance for the first time, can't give it up. They're the ones who are at risk. What creates the risk? Before I go there, let me tell you something more about the medical perspective on addiction, a valid perspective. That in many, many ways, addictions are self-medications for other emotional, mental health conditions. Now, I mentioned dopamine. Dopamine is important for attention and motivation. If you have ADHD, which about 25-30% of you at least do in this room, statistically, according to the studies, about that percentage of alcoholics actually have ADHD. And a couple of times that I've been to 12-step meetings, I could see it all over the place. Yeah. Well, and by the way, I have it myself. I was diagnosed at age 52 with ADHD. And for a while, I took medication for it. And the medication you get for ADHD, like Ritalin or Dexedrine, what do? They elevate dopamine levels in the brain. Well, what else, you know, because and the stimulant elevates dopamine levels, so it calms you down. I won't go into how that works, but that's how it works. Now, here's the point. Cocaine elevates dopamine levels as well. So people with ADHD tend to use cocaine. What else elevates dopamine levels? Nicotine does. Now put your hand up if you've been addicted to nicotine in your life. Okay, congratulations. Because about 70% of alcoholics are addicted to nicotine as well. Because nicotine elevates dopamine levels. And you actually calm down with it. When I talk about in this book to this 12-step meeting I went to, and after the meeting was over, everybody rushes outside. And then the parking lot smoking away, self-medicating their ADHD. Because the nicotine elevates the dopamine level, just like the Ritalin would. So people self-medicate ADHD. Now, alcohol also self-medicates ADHD because it calms down their hyperactive brain, as does marijuana, by the way. In other words, people self-medicate. What else do people self-medicate? PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Opiates and alcohol are self-medications for PTSD. They create more problems, of course, but in the short term, they soothe the problem. So addiction is all about the short-term relief versus the long-term harm, isn't it? People self-medicate depression. People self-medicate social phobia. You know, if you have a few drinks, you can be more socially uninhibited because your inhibition has been inhibited. So you're not so inhibited anymore. Because what alcohol does is it releases the inhibition chemical GABA in the brain and it suppresses the activation chemical glutamate in the brain. So now you're more inhibited, but not that you're socially more inhibited. The inhibition circuits are more inhibited, so you're less inhibited. So you can go out there and socialize and feel confident about yourself. Well, that's pretty important. That's not a bad thing, to be less inhibited. It's a bad thing to need the alcohol to get there. But what I'm saying about addiction is that the mind states that people after actually are the mind states that we all want to have. Pain relief, social connection, a lack of inhibition in a negative way, more creativity, more excitement, more reward. Who wouldn't want that? Now the question is, why do people need the alcohol route or the substance route? And this is where medical science tells us the answer, And medical practice completely misses the answer. There's a huge gap between the research knowledge that we now possess and the practice that still dominates mainstream medical thinking. Because here's the reality, and here's, by the way, why the genetic theories are completely false. Because the human brain, it turns out, does not develop in a vacuum, and it does not develop according to a genetic program. The human brain is actually shaped by the environment, people. The kind of conditions that you are, that you face in the uterus after you're born, particularly in the first few years, actually shape the development of brain circuitry. Now, I don't make this stuff up. I'm just telling you what the science tells us. This is not even controversial. It's not controversial. This is what the science has clearly established. So which circuits develop, and which properly, and which don't, depends very much on the environment. Now, including how the genes work. There was a study this week published in a major journal that showed that stress on the mother in a child's first few years of life affects how the genes work in that child, even in teenagehood. Stress on the father in the preschool years affects how the genes in that person work, even in teenagehood. Now, the reason that the human brain is so susceptible to the environment is because most of our brain development happens not in the uterus, but on the outside. Now, if you look at a horse, it can run on the first day of life. It's that much more advanced than we are. For human beings, you need about 18 months to get to that level of coordination and balance and visual acuity and strength. So why can't we be born as advanced as the horses? Well, the reason is that we have much bigger heads in relationship to our bodies, and already at birth, the head is the biggest part of the body, number one. Number two, the pelvis, the human pelvis, in order to accommodate our capacity to walk on two legs, had to become narrower. So now we have a narrower pelvis and a larger head. The compromise is we have to be born prematurely compared to other animals. And it means that most of our brain development happens on the outside, not on the inside. So the human brain is the only one that continues to grow at the same rate outside the uterus as it did inside. And much of that happens in the first 3 years of life. So that 80% of the increase in the size of the brain happens after birth and not before, and 80% of that happens in the first 3 years of life. So by the end of the third year, your brain is 80% the size of the adult brain, or 90% the size of the adult brain, where your body is only 16 or 17% the size of the adult body. A huge disproportion, and a rapid period of brain growth. So that there are times in the first year of life when every second, now think of this, in that space of time, a million connections are being made in the brain. And which connections are being made and which connections are not being made depends on environmental input. So if a child is born with perfectly good eyes at birth and good genes, but he doesn't see light for 3 years because you keep him in a dark room, he'll be blind for the rest of his life. Because the circuits of vision need light waves for their development. The circuits of emotional self-regulation, the circuits of opiate, pain relief, social connection, love, reward, the dopamine circuits of motivation, incentive, the stress regulation, the emotional self-regulation circuits also need the right environment. And what is that? And look at your life, and look at your family's history. The necessary conditions for those circuits to develop properly are the presence of non-stressed, emotionally available, consistently available, non-depressed parenting caregivers. So the necessary condition for the development of these crucial brain circuits is the presence of non-stressed, non-depressed, attuned, emotionally available, consistently available parenting caregivers. This happens already in uterus. You can stress pregnant animals, their offspring will be more likely to use alcohol and cocaine as adults. You can stress pregnant women, their children are more likely to be addicts. This has happened. Women who are abused in pregnancy, their kids are more likely to be addicts. because already the circuits doing are affected by the mother's emotional states in the uterus. Because a stressed mother secretes a lot of cortisol, which is a stress hormone, and that interferes with the brain development of the child. And this continues for the first 3 years. So that first 3 years. So if a mother is depressed, for example, if your mother is postpartum depression, your cortisol, your stress hormone levels will be abnormal even in the third year of life. Women who were stressed by 9/11 and they were pregnant, their offspring had abnormal stress hormone levels at 1 year of age. Women who are depressed in a child's first year of life, you can look at an electroencephalogram, an EEG of the infant at 6 months of age. You can look at the electrical printout of the child's brain activity, and you can tell from the child's EEG whose mother was depressed and whose wasn't. This has been done in Seattle. I could go on and on and on about this. The number of dopamine receptors, the number of endorphin receptors have to do with how stressed were the parents. Now, if you actually look at the large-scale population studies on alcoholism and other addictions, what do you find? What you find is a high preponderance of what has been called adverse childhood experiences. An adverse childhood experience is the death of a parent, the loss of a parent due to a rancorous divorce, abuse in the family, or you know, physical, sexual, or emotional abuse. I don't have any female patients in Vancouver in the downtown east side who were not sexually abused as kids. Many of you were sexually abused in this room, I know it. Statistically, that's just how it is. Physically, emotionally. Violence in a family, addiction in the family, a parent being jailed. And for each of these adverse childhood experiences, the risk of addiction goes up exponentially. They don't just add to each other, they multiply one another. So the more of these adverse childhood experiences have you had, the more likely you are to become an addict as you grow up. You may be born with certain genes that predispose for addictions. This has been shown in monkeys, and in human beings. There's a group of monkeys that are predisposed to be alcoholics. And why? Because they have a gene that protects them from the sedative effects of alcohol. So they can drink all they want and they don't fall down, they don't lose their coordination, and they don't go to sleep. Now, wouldn't you like that?
Yeah.
You know? Genetically, they can get as high, so they don't have the negative effect. Now, genetically, they're protected from that. But you think their addiction is genetic? No, it isn't. Because those monkeys that are brought up by their mothers, that gene is inactivated. And only those monkeys that are brought up away from their mothers is that gene activated. The gene does not cause the addiction. It makes it more likely, but it's the connection with the mother or the lack of it that actually creates the addictive drive. And the same thing has been shown in human beings. That's not in my book, because the book was published in the States a couple of years ago, 2010, and the study came out last year. Certain children who are born with some genetic traits that might predispose them to addictions, if they're brought up in nurturing families, they never become addicted. The genes don't define anything. As I said earlier, genes aren't turned on and off by the environment. So genes being there doesn't tell you what's going to happen. It's how does the gene interact with the environment? And again, the more of these adverse childhood experiences that a person has sustained in their growing years, the more likely they are to become addicted. Incidentally, the more likely they are to have diseases of all kinds, unless they don't learn how to take care of themselves. So that's basically the nuts and bolts of it scientifically, that the brain is a diseased organ in addiction. It becomes more diseased as the addiction progresses. It was abnormal to start with. It was that abnormality that created the predisposition. But what created the abnormality in the first place? Childhood adversity. Now, you may say to me, I was never beaten, abused, or anything like that. Nobody ever died. Well, that may be true. I'm not saying that every addict had those experiences. I'm saying that the more of those experiences a person had, the more likely it is that they become addicts. But there's something else that can happen as well. I mentioned that the necessary conditions were the presence of emotionally available, consistently available, attuned, non-stressed, non-depressed parenting caregivers. You don't have to be abused. But what if your parents were very stressed? What if your parents were very stressed? What if your parents were so stressed that emotionally they couldn't quite read you because they were too taken up with their own stuff because of economic or social stress? What's happening right now in North America? Because of the economic crisis. Two people having to work. Kids are less and less with their parents. The parents, when they're home, they're very stressed. Emotionally, they're not as available to their kids. The California UCLA-based psychologist, Alan Shore, talks about what he calls proximal separation, where the parent is physically there, but emotionally not. So your parents could have been there. They could have loved you. They could have done their very best. This is not about blaming the parent. Parents did their best. Believe me, as a parent, I did their best. But my own best was limited by my own emotional maturation, which wasn't much when my kids were small. Now, I've had my own addictive issues, not with substances, but with certain behaviors. And let me tell you something. There are not many different addictions. There's only one universal addiction process. Whether you look at gamblers or shoppers or sexaholics or alcoholics or cocaine addicts or morphine addicts, the same brain circuits are involved, the same emotional dynamics are involved, and the same desperate emptiness is inside that person. In my case, that showed up in the form of workaholism and in the form of a particular shopaholism where I had to buy classical compact discs. Now, you laugh, but 1 week I spent $8,000 on them. And I'm not exactly sure what I'm getting applause for here, but I can tell you my wife sure wasn't applauding very much. And I left a woman in labor in hospital to go get a disc. Now, if you actually look at my brain at that moment, it's got the same dopamine hunger that the alcoholic has. You have to have it right now. So there's a universal addiction process. It doesn't matter what. And also, of course, there's a universal addiction process. We know this because people rarely have just have one addiction. The majority here put their hand up when asked about nicotine. And many of you will have other addiction patterns as well. A large percentage of gamblers are alcoholics. And they have several addictions going at the same time. Many sexaholics have alcoholism as well. So that it's just not that there's all these different addictions. It's that there's a universal addiction process involving the same emotional dynamics, same brain circuits. It just finds different targets. And very often, if a person gives up smoking, what frequently happens to them? They put on weight because the same addictive drive now goes into the food, which means that sobriety is not about stopping to use a particular substance. You stop using the substance, that's called abstinence. And that's a good thing, but it's not the same as sobriety. Because sobriety by this definition has to do with dealing with the fundamental addiction process. And so it's not just giving up alcohol. It's actually becoming capable of taking charge of your life. So you're not driven by internal impulses. You don't go from relationship to relationship. You go from substance to substance. You don't go from this to shopping, from shopping to eating. Okay, you've given up the alcohol, but what about the rest of your life? So as you well know, sobriety is a much bigger picture, much bigger issue than simply abstinence. And for that to happen, you have to really tackle the whole mechanism, the whole dynamic. And if I have to say, in the book, I express a lot of appreciation for AA and its approach, and the 12 steps in particular. Not only did I appreciate them, I even rewrote them. The way it's formulated, it speaks to a lot of people, but it doesn't speak to everybody. And yet the principles that are involved in the 12 steps are necessary for everybody who's involved in addiction. So the words don't matter so much. It's the principles that matter. I mean, some people are just allergic to the word God, as you know. And why are they allergic to the word God? Because somebody in a priest caste like used to abuse them sexually. Why would they not be allergic to that word? Well, that's okay. It's only a word. There is this higher power. Doesn't matter what it's called. You know, so I rewrote those 12 steps. Not the principles are the same, but I just languished it differently. And certainly, the essential first step of admitting that you have no power. Now, again, that's hard for people, for some people. Because if you were abused as a kid, your position was one of complete powerlessness. Am I going to admit again that I'm powerless? That makes me a victim all over again. That's the way some people's minds work. I'm not saying that's how it is. But I think of it differently. I'm not admitting that I'm powerless. I'm admitting that my ego is powerless. I'm admitting that, and I tell you, even with my compact disc addiction, even though there was no physical withdrawal like there's with alcohol or other substances, I tell you, it was a significant addiction, and the price was paid by my family. Because it doesn't matter, the whole world thought I was a great doctor, but for my kids, I wasn't emotionally available. Now, why wasn't I emotionally available? It has to do with my infancy. This is why this is multi-generational. I wasn't emotionally available because when I was an infant, I was born as a Jewish kid in Nazi-occupied Hungary, and my family went through those terrible times. And my mother was a traumatized, depressed, emotionally downtrodden individual who barely could ensure my survival physically, let alone give me what I needed emotionally. So the message I got from the world that I wasn't wanted. Now, how do you deal with not being wanted? One way you deal with not being wanted is to make yourself needed. They may not want me, but they're going to need me. So many children of alcoholics grow up to be people pleasers. Because that's their substitute. Their substitute for not being loved is to make themselves needed by being nice to everybody and always saying yes to everybody, whatever they want, and then they get cancer. Because that's what happens. When you don't know how to say no, your body will say it for you in a form of disease. Now, in my case, the sense of not being wanted, and it had nothing to do with whether my mother loved me or not. But the sense of not being wanted then is compensated for by me becoming this really important doctor. Well, great, except I was there for the whole world except my own family. Now my children get the sense that they're not wanted because daddy's not around. And daddy's always thinking about other things. Or daddy's buying compact discs when he should be with us. And that happened. So what message did they get? So now they have their own problems and issues to deal with as adults. I passed it on to them, but I didn't pass it on genetically. I just passed it on. Biologically, yes, but not genetically. And that's the good news, by the way, because if it's genetic, it is a much bigger problem because you can't get rid of it. You got the genes you got. The whole idea of healing, and by the way, the whole idea of the success of the 12-step programs is precisely predicated, even though they say they're born with it and it's ingrained in them, the reality is that if it was, nobody could ever give it up. The fact that you can give it up and transform is precisely because the human physiology and the human brain and therefore the human personality and the human soul has infinite capacity for growth and development and transformation. And that is called neuroplasticity in neurological terms, the capacity of the brain to develop new circuits even later on in life. Now, what is the necessary condition for that? It's precisely what AA provides. The necessary condition for transformation, for that neuroplasticity, is a sense of belonging and safety and being loved. And that's what I see you guys doing for one another here. There's a spiritual teacher here in California whose name is Almas, and he says that only when compassion is present will people allow themselves to see the truth. So the AA program is a very compassionate one. That is the secret to its success. In addition to the other steps, it's that compassion and that non-judgment, that acceptance that maybe you've experienced for the first time in your life when you went to your first 12-step meeting. That's what allows the transformation to happen. Because here's another scientific truth about the human brain and the human nervous system. Basically, we have three levels of responses. The first one is reptilian, the second one is mammalian, and the third one is mostly human. The reptilian response, and it's built into our nervous system, is withdrawal and immobilization and freezing. So people freeze emotionally, and you know that. And one of the ways that I respond when I'm not happy at home with my wife of 42 years is I freeze. I go into this reptilian state of immobile facial expression and flat voice and not even looking at her. Now, the second level of response is the fight or flight response, which is when you fight back or you try to escape, which involves another part of the nervous system. And the highest level of response is the social engagement system. When you look somebody in the eye and you speak to them in a voice that's modulated with emotion, and you listen to what they say, and you turn towards them. Now, when the social engagement system is engaged, your internal emotional state is calmer, your nervous system is calmer, and your heart beats slower, and you are in a receptive and physiologically more nourished state. Now, for the human being to be able to be in that socially engaged state, which is the only state that we learn anything in, we have to have a sense of safety. We have to have a sense of being loved and accepted and connected with. When you're in that state, then you can learn, then you can develop, then you can look at what doesn't work, then you can give up patterns that didn't serve you very well. But when you're attacked, when you feel attacked, when you perceive yourself as being under threat, you're in defensive mode. Either in that frozen mode, and you know what I'm talking about, many of you, or you're in that flight or fight mode, in that state, you're stupid. All you can do is attempt to survive. And this is why the social ostracization and opprobrium and isolation of people with addiction issues is so harmful. Because when you stress people, and when you attack people, and when you demean people, when you don't connect to what's happening with them, and you don't see their pain, you're simply reinforcing their need to escape. Instead of helping them, you're helping to entrench them in their addictive patterns. And this is what AA broke out of so brilliantly, by providing that environment of safety and acceptance. So there's many, many good things that I perceive about your program. The part where you perceive me disagreeing is this genetic idea, which is just based on old science that most doctors don't even know about, so I can hardly blame non-doctors. And that it's based on, I think there could be more looking at people's particular experience. Not in order to feel sorry for yourself, not in order to blame it to your parents or anything like that, but simply in order to understand yourself compassionately. Because if you understand what this is all about, that you didn't choose this consciously or deliberately, you're responsible for it. You're the only one that can respond. So you're the one who's response-able. Nobody else is response-able for you. I can't respond for you. You can't respond for me. You're responsible, but you're not to be blamed. And if you get what I'm saying about the childhood experience, and also if you see the kind of patterns, and I'll stop talking here so I can answer some questions and have some discussion, but let me read you just one paragraph from this book here, just to illustrate one of the things that happens to addicts. And this is from a chapter in the book called Know Thine Enemy. Detective Sergeant Paul Gillespie, head of Toronto Sex Crimes Unit, rescued children from the purveyors of internet pornography. So this cop, he made it his job to rescue kids from being abused on the internet. He was very good at it. As a Canadian newspaper, the Globe and Mail, reported on his retirement from police work, 6 years at that job had not inured him to the horrors he witnessed. So the article said, Paul Gillespie still can't get used to the sounds of crying and pain in the graphic videos of children being raped and molested that he has seen all too often on the web. It's beyond horrible to listen to the soundtracks of these movies, said Canada's best-known child porn cop. But it is the silent images of desolate children that tear most at his heart. They're not screaming, just accepting, he said, of the infants captured in these pictures. They have dead eyes. You can tell that their spirit is broken. That's their life. Now, there's two points to be made here. One is a legal, political one. It's not so relevant to your conference here, but because your choice, your drug of choice, so-called, is alcohol. But if your drug of choice was heroin, and there's no difference, by the way, in terms of its devastating effect on the human body, alcohol, if anything, is worse. Not that I'm advocating that you should try heroin. But if that had been your route, then that same policeman, his job would not be to capture you and put you into jail. He tried to rescue you when you were a kid, but if he didn't rescue you, his job would not be to put you behind bars. This is the nonsense of our legal system when it comes to addictions. Now, that's the first point, but the second point is those dead eyes. Now, why do people's eyes go dead? Why do they go dead? It's a protection. The child doesn't do it, the child's brain does it. It's the only way that the child can protect himself is by shutting down his feelings of emotion, because he can't escape. There's no way to help. So he has to shut down emotionally. Now, why is that important to know? Because for myself, I mentioned to you that one of my responses when I'm unhappy is to shut down emotionally. You know this too. One of the, I'm going to just pull back, hell with them all. You know, I'm going to, you know. That emotional shutdown and then not feeling your feelings. And when the feelings become too strong, then you have to kill them with alcohol. That's what's driving your addiction. So in order to feel alive again, so you can feel alive without the substance, you have to feel your emotions again. So in order to understand yourself in the present, it's helpful, very helpful, to understand what happened to you as a child. Again, not so that you can feel like a victim of something, because you're not a victim of anything, because here you are, capable and capacity with the capacity to respond, but simply to understand yourself compassionately. So before I take your questions then, let me just summarize it. In a nutshell, addictions are very human activities. They're normal human responses to abnormal circumstances, is what they are. They create their own problems, but in the first place, they're designed to solve a problem. They're not a good way to solve a problem, but the person engaged in it doesn't know that in the beginning. And then they get hooked. And we now know that those predispositions are created by early experience, their physiological effects on the brain, and their psychological and emotional impact on the adult. And the whole thing about becoming sober is physiologically, not just abstinent, but sober is physiologically and psychologically, and as AA teaches very powerfully, spiritually liberating yourself from the past. Thanks very much. All right, well, those of you that wish to stay then, so let me just mention one thing. This is, I know you gotta go smoke. I know that. A version of this lecture is available at my website. You can watch it, doesn't cost any money. The website is www, and then my name, drgabormate.com. You can see interviews and videos and lectures and articles and so on there. And the book that I was reading from is called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. Now, any questions? And there's a mic here that Greg will, is it Greg? Yeah? It will carry around and we'll take your questions. You know, I won't take it personally if you leave. I'll feel rejected, but, you know. Okay, go ahead. Yeah, who's got the mic? Just give it to anybody you want. It's up to you.
Hi, thanks a lot. That was great. We emphasize a spiritual approach and altruism.
Yeah.
So aside from the spiritual approach and altruism, through other means, how have you resolved the pain reduction and that getting that motivation and goals up and that internal self-regulation? Has anything else been effective at preventing people from relapse and maintain abstinence?
Well, so how do you maintain sobriety? How do you maintain abstinence? How do you deal with all the emotional stuff that's there without the 12-step program? Well, look, it's not so much without, but what else can you add? You know, and I think that what's really important is that people look at their lives from this perspective of what actually happened to me and what traces of the past do I still carry with me. Because what happens is that if you learned early in life that relationships aren't safe, then you're going to spend your whole life afraid of intimacy. Now, human being needs intimacy. Human being need social contact, emotional contact. But if you're afraid of social contact or intimate contact, if you're afraid of your vulnerability, then you're going to keep yourself from having meaningful relationships. In other words, you're going to keep yourself isolated. Now, isolation is one of the drivers of addiction. The more you isolate people, the more addicted they're likely to be. So, in order to deal with your tendency to avoid intimacy, you have to deal with your emotional stuff. Not just concentrate on the drug or the substance, but look at the emotions that you're dealing with. Realize that your fear of emotional contact, or sometimes your almost addictive tendency to get into people who are emotionally abusive to you. There's two things that can happen to people who are mistreated. One is they can imagine there's danger where there's actually safety, but the other is they won't see the danger when it exists. So women typically who abuse their kids end up with abusive men. Because when you were a child, whose love did you most want? Of some abusive guy, your father. So therefore, when you see an abusive guy, he won't even have abused you, but you recognize it unconsciously. And that's whose love you're going to want. Well, if you're going to do that, you're also going to make yourself more prone to turn to alcohol, because if you're being abused as an adult, you're going to drink to kill your pain. In other words, what I'm saying is you've got to deal with your emotional stuff, one way or the other.
Great talk. Thanks. Very informative. What's your take on some of the more modern alcohol treatment methods using opiate blockers such as naltrexone?
Yeah. You know, anything that can break the trajectory of alcohol use is helpful. So, I mean, you know, in people who are addicted to heroin, we'll give them Suboxone or methadone. That's still an addiction, but it's a bit easier to manage, much easier to manage than the heroin. That's a step forward. It's the same with naloxone and use of alcoholism. If it helps somebody give up the alcohol, I'm all in favor of it. It's only that it's a very mechanical and very narrow approach. It's not enough. You've got to deal with all this other stuff as well. Otherwise, the underlying drive will still reassert itself. In other words, it's not enough to deal with the mechanics of the substance. You also have to deal with the fundamental addiction drive that is based on childhood experience. But in itself, yes, it's a good thing. It's your call there, Greg. Or is it? Yeah, sorry.
Okay. Hi. My name's Ed, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ed.
And a food addict. And I have ADHD, and wow. On and on and on, all right? Yeah. I get one under control, another one pops up. So I know exactly what you're talking about. First of all, in the readings, I never saw in the big book or in Silkworth's article that any of this was genetic. In fact, it was defined as being progressive, and you could cross the line, all right? And okay. nor being constitutionally...
Now, didn't I hear today a couple of times that you were born with it?
No. It's not in the book.
Okay.
It's not in the book.
Okay,
so,
great.
Personally, I am total agreement with what you've said, and you were saying something that's just not in the book. So now if you got that, you're perfect from my point of view. But what I really want to know about is you said you were ADHD, and this is new to me, and you said you had been on medication. You're apparently not now.
Yeah,
so what do I do about this? Because it's causing me problems. Thank you.
Well, sure. Again, according to one large-scale study, 40% of adult male alcoholics actually have ADHD. 40%. Now, it's a big question. It's another talk. But the good news here is that at any age, the brain can rewire itself. And so it's, and you've already experienced that in your life. So it's a matter of experiencing it some more. And the quickest access I can give you, and I don't know how to do this without self-advertising, my very first book is on the subject of ADHD. It's entitled Scattered. It's available here in the States. Read it. And if you know, and it'll give you a lot of advice, and if not enough, then you send me an email. Okay? Yeah, now. And you might want to move further to the back as well, just to give people else in the room a chance.
Well, I apologize. We're going to go with the female.
Thank you. Now, is there any possibility of shutting that door over there? I'm just getting too much feedback from the outside there. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Thank you. I just want to ask quickly, there's a lot you hear pro and con about taking like antidepressants and things to bring back up. Yeah. And you mentioned taking the ADHD, but now you're not on them. So I'd like
but
to hear a
what?
Little bit.
You but
said you were taking medicine,
I was. I also,
and now you're not.
I've also taken antidepressants.
Can you share
a bit? I've taken Prozac, and Prozac, as you know, is one of those SSRI drugs. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. They create, or they facilitate the presence of more serotonin in the brain, and serotonin is another important brain chemical, important in mood regulation. Now, the same dynamics that affect dopamine and endorphins also affect serotonin in childhood, so that when you're very stressed as an infant or as a child, you're likely to lack serotonin. So the first time I took Prozac was in my 40s, and within 2 days, I said, you mean people can feel like this normally? I didn't realize how depressed I'd been until I was not depressed anymore. You know? Now, many people who are drinking are actually self-medicating depression. I'm all in favor of the judicious use of antidepressant medications. They're just not the answer, you got to understand. They have to create a mind state where you can actually deal with things, but they don't provide the answer. So if all I did was took Prozac, but I did nothing else for myself, when I stopped taking the Prozac, you go back into the depression. So if you're going to take antidepressants, that's fine. And I see it as a good thing. And nobody who's not been depressed would understand what the heck I'm talking about. But if you have been depressed, you know exactly what I mean. But use the medication to buy yourself time to do the work. To deal with the emotional issues. To deal with the relationship issues, to deal with the negative self-talk, to deal with all the stuff that goes along with depression, and then you can gradually come off the antidepressants and put some healthy life habits into your life, you know, meditation and exercise and healthy eating and social contact and all that kind of thing. Then you won't need to be on the antidepressant for the rest of your life. Most people will not be. So, unfortunately, the psychiatric profession is very medication-oriented. That's all they know how to do, many of them. And so it's a very limited service that they provide. And they don't even know what they're, you know, they're not taught any different. So you can't rely on the medical profession to be the answer for you. Yeah.
How's it going? Hi.
Well, I mean, if you're going to go by the rules here, you can't.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to be an advocate for the Darwinian approach, which I haven't heard so far. If you may indulge me to speak on it.
Look, I'm telling you, I think that right now, I mean, I appreciate that you really want to say something, but I also know that we've had a certain procedure here, which we're trying to follow. That's all, you know.
Thank you. So our literature describes us as a progressive thing, progressively exhaustible. I don't know why it's doing that. Progressively exhaustible supply of relief, the substances, but the recovery program appears to be inexhaustible. And our literature also says that recovery is a substitute for the substances. So how do you understand that scientifically?
Well, the substances are exhaustible for two reasons. One is the supply might run out, period. Secondly, you're going to destroy your system. Physically, you're going to destroy your brain, you're going to destroy your liver, destroy your heart, and alcohol can do all that, as you know, so that you become exhaustible, not just the substance. You're exhaustible yourself. Recovery or healing generates energy in you. It generates cells. It generates new nerve circuits. It generates a different relationship to yourself. In other words, it's infinitely nourishing in its dynamics and in its consequences. And that's how I understand the difference.
So I have a bit of a controversial question.
And where are you?
Question.
Sorry.
I'm in the back.
Okay, yeah.
So you mentioned that your brain can be rewired.
Yeah.
Can an alcoholic ever rewire their brain that they can drink in moderation?
I got two. I have. It's a great question. I have two answers to that. The answer is yes, and the answer is no. Okay. Now, let me tell you why. Because the fact is, not only can many people have. That's the reality of it. Many people have. If you fully dealt with the addiction process in yourself, if that spiritual hunger is satisfied. So you're not an empty vessel anymore, having to fill yourself all the time from the outside. If you're in respectful and mutually nourishing relationship with other human beings, if you have meaningful activity in your work, and if you have a strong connection to your higher power, then the answer is absolutely yes. But hold on, you know. On the other hand, statistically, the odds are low, okay? Because that takes a lot. That takes a lot. And you've already demonstrated to yourself amply that your system is prone to that particular addictive route. So if I'm going to make an assumption, I better make the assumption that, no, you better not drink again. You know? Having said that, the truthful scientific answer is that, yes, it's possible. Okay, but the question is, do you want to be your own guinea pig on that particular question?
Hi, thanks for your work. It's brilliant and it's so timely that I think people need to hear these very kinds of things. My question is, transgenerationally, looking back one, two, and three generations,
yeah.
Have you seen? I know there are studies about grandparents who've gone through famine in Ireland and only ate potatoes. And generations later, there's alcoholism to vodka. I mean, all those kinds of things that are proving out. Have you seen that and worked with the transgenerational traumas as well?
Well, yeah, absolutely. This is multigenerational. You can look at, for example, cortisol is a stress hormone. So you can look at the cortisol levels of the children of Holocaust survivors who have PTSD. The children don't, the parents do. But the greater the level of the PTSD of the parent, the higher the cortisol level of the child. Now, trauma is passed from one generation to the next. If you look at the Native American population here, the Native Indians, so-called, you know what? There was alcohol in North America before the coming of the Caucasians. And they used alcohol, just as used other substances, including tobacco and peyote. But how did they use them? Spiritually. They were not addicted. But then what happened is that, if you know your American history at all, then many of your greatest military heroes were also mass murderers when it came to the natives, you know? And, you know, people like Phil Sheridan, who was one of the Civil War heroes, a cavalry leader under Ulysses S. Grant, was murderous in his approach to the Native Indians here on the plains. Now, people were traumatized, and then in Canada, they were forced into residential homes where they were taken away from their parents. Their parenting ways were completely destroyed. They lost their connection with the elders and with their parents, and they were sexually abused. So now you have Native reservations where you have an 80% addiction rate and a high sexual abuse rate, high alcoholism rate, glue sniffing, anything you can name under the sun. It's got nothing genetic about it, but it's multi-generational because the trauma has been passed on from one generation to the next. This is multi-generational, and that's why there's no individual here to be blamed.
Unfortunately, this is the last one because we're supposed to be out of here in 3 minutes.
Okay.
My name's Claire. I'm an alcoholic. My question was, what effect do you think spirituality has on the chemical processes of our brain?
Well, you know, human beings are beings who are spiritual by nature. That's who we are, I believe. In other words, we need to connect to something larger than just a little personalities in our bodies and our egos. That need to connect is part of who we are. It's not just something that we created or made up. Some of the ideas we have around it may be kind of funny, but especially in this country. but the basic need is a genuine human drive, and we can see it in all human societies. To lose connection with that is to deny part of who we are. And who we are physiologically and who we are emotionally, psychologically, and which makes us into spiritual creatures. And parts of our brain actually are wired to that spiritual connection. So that making that spiritual connection, as again AA does, I think is absolutely essential, not just for healing of addiction, but also for any kind of a balanced, healthy human life.
Let's thank our speaker.